Richard C. Hoagland is a former Space Science Museum curator, a former NASA consultant, and during the historic Apollo missions to the moon, was science advisor to Walter Cronkite in CBS News. For the last 19, 20 years now, Richard Hoagland has been leading an outside scientific team in a critically acclaimed independent analysis of possibly intelligently designed artifacts on Mars. The last 4 years, he and his team's investigations have been extended to include more than 30 years of previously hidden data from NASA, Soviet, and Pentagon missions to the moon. Tonight, on Coast to Coast, Richard C. Hoagland. Hello, Richard. How are you?
Good evening, George.
And let me say, happy birthday, Mr.
Hoagland. Well, thank you.
Happy birthday, indeed. As a matter of fact, later in the program, in tribute to your birthday, I have a little present for you, but I'll tell you about it later on the air, by the way, Richard C., but we'll do that a little bit later on tonight.
And I have a story because Steve Bassett at the conference surprised me on the banquet night, on Saturday night, with an interesting birthday surprise.
Excellent.
So
well,
if you want to do birthdays, yes. And by the way, it's not even here yet. It's April 25th, so this is one heck of a birthday. In fact, this whole last weekend, George, was the most remarkable, phenomenal birthday present that I think I've ever gotten, because I can actually say that the D word, disclosure, seems to be very, very near.
That has got to be for you and so many other people in your field, Richard, who have been working on this all their lives, all their career. It's got to be exciting to know that.
Well,
it's close,
seems
huh?
like all my life, actually.
It does.
Been, you know, about a third of it, but it's a long way to Tipperary, and it's a long way to Washington. And by the way, one slight correction: I'm not home. I am in Washington tonight.
Oh, you're still there?
We're here because we have nonstop meetings on the Hill. All the people who showed up at the conference, and all the people who have emailed their representatives, have set up a remarkable process. This is why I've been really looking forward to doing this show tonight, because for all the millions out there who have stuck with us and listened to our story of discovery suppressed, discovery delayed, discovery hidden in a drawer, we are so close because of your participation tonight to some very important developments and revelations and moving on with where this has to go, that the 3 hours we're going to have minus the other time is not enough, but we'll be able to give it a good college try in terms of where are we, where we can go, and specifically the things we're going to need from this audience tonight to do in the next few days. So get a pencil and paper ready, or turn on the light, get out of bed, get to your desk. I warn you, there's some critical time issues here that require your decision-making, your intervention to make the next part of this ongoing saga come true.
Richard, when you and I, months ago, were talking about the X conference with Stephen Bassett, Stephen, of course, and as he said on Monday night, very briefly, as we had him on for a very quick update, talked about just how nervous it was for him to be putting on this conference, because he didn't know what direction it would go. He didn't know if it would have enough people in attendance. He was working on getting the right guests up there. Well, you were there, Richard. You were a witness to what happened. Tell me a little bit about that conference. Were you happy with its results and what's happening?
I was so gratified at the way this audience came through and expressed their wish that this national nightmare, this incredible charade that we've been living under for decades, come to an end and we get on what we have to be doing. And people responded. We had almost 700 participants. We had very significant press, the right kind of press, in particular some folks from overseas that I'm going to be talking to at some length, because there's a lot more openness, as you know, beyond the shores of the United States on this subject, on these issues, than there is here so far. We had, I think, 9 PhDs in terms of speakers. We had 5 countries represented. We had 25 presenters overall. I did 5 hours myself alone to something like 500 or 600 people, George.
That's all? Just 5 hours for you?
Just 5 hours. And I split into 2 days so that people could actually get bathroom breaks and stuff like that.
And how about the attendees? Do you get a lot of people there?
We had, well, almost 700. And in mine, you know, because there were 25 of us, so, you know, we had people like Stephen Greer and Jim Mars and, you know, Timothy Good and Nick Pope, and, I mean, I could go down the list. But if you want to see who was there, you simply go to theenterprisemission.com, and you scroll down to the right-hand side of the main page, and there's an ex-conference file, and you can go and see what you missed. That's the bad news. The good news for everybody who could not make it on this short notice to Washington for this seminal event, and I don't use that term lightly, George, this was a seminal watershed event, as I think by the time the night is over, you will agree that something has changed. And the reason I know that is because of the political response that we're getting from the Hill. The people who make decisions in this country are your and my representatives.
Would this have happened, Richard, if this conference were held in a different city outside of Washington, D.C.,
no,
in that
not
area?
Not at all. This is why we've over the years held our events, enterprise events, you know, at various points in our research at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., downtown Washington,
mm-hmm.
because the press and the Congress are, I don't want to say lazy. I mean, that's a kind of a cheap shot. The problem is that we have too few people minding too many things of the nation's and the people's business with too little support, staff support. So if you're going to get anybody to pay attention to what you're doing, you basically have to hold it in their living room. And that's what Steve did. He very cleverly put this conference literally in their backyard so that the staff people that we could invite and invade mm-hmm. to come could be delegated to come and kind of check us out. Do you know that before I began my second presentation on Sunday night, I had two staff people come up and quietly slip me their cards, legislative assistants? That's when I knew this was going to be a success. And what we've done is spend the last several days following up with phone calls, and I have an amazing story that we'll tell in maybe the next half hour about meeting one member of Congress, one actual representative, in the most incredible serendipitous fashion. I mean, this is the kind of thing that Chris Carter would have to write. But it actually happened for real, and it wound up with a key meeting we're having tomorrow morning on the Hill.
What was the mood of the participants? Because, you know, they go to a lot of conferences. They, you know, they have information that they present. Were they beginning to feel, as you do now, that there's something different here?
You know, it's so funny you should use that expression. Because I mean, and by the way, let me say as a you know footnote here, you were really missed. If you had been able to be here, and to see what went on, and to participate, and to give a speech, you know, the speech that I wrote for you.
You did not write a speech for me.
You would have been a tremendous hit because you're a connection. You are a link in the night to all these people who have felt disenfranchised for so long. And through you and through art and this program, I believe that this is turning around. And when you get back to the feeling, after I finished on Sunday night, and I was the Tom Van Flandern and I were the last presenters of the conference, except for a little wrap-up ceremony that all of the speakers, you know, stayed around for. I think we ended something like 10:15 in the evening on Sunday night. And I had a couple of you come up to me who I'd never met, you know, who had just come many miles to see what was going on. And they said, these are total strangers. They said things like, you've been to a lot of these, Mr. Hoagland. Do you feel there's something different here? And it was so interesting because my dear administrative assistant, who I have not seen literally in 5 years, who lives on the East Coast and is, you know, doing other things now.
Sure.
I mean, we talked, we've emailed, but we haven't physically seen each other. She and her significant other drove down from upstate New York so that she could be part of this and see where we are. And the metaphor I used was it was kind of like being on a dark night and you have a stab of lightning, a flash of lightning, and you see the landscape almost like a flashbulb shot. And she and I were comparing notes, and she said, this is different. There's something going on. There is a new mood of seriousness. It's not just airy-fairy. Isn't it cute to know this stuff? It's meaningful. It's politically time. It's time has come. Or my favorite saying is from old Mark Twain. You know, Mark Twain was Sam Clemens, and, you know, he wrote about steamboats going up and down the Mississippi mm-hmm. River. Remember his greatest line, George, which was, when it's steamboat time, you steam. And it's steamboat time.
Could you notice if there were some people there who were watching you and the other participants that might have been governmental people?
Oh, yeah. Well, we had those who identified themselves as governmental
people. No, I mean those that didn't identify
and
themselves.
And those that didn't. And it's kind of funny because before we left, I got a call from one of my intel sources, you know, the black ops crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And I stood up there at the podium on Saturday, which was my designated political day. Sunday I did data. I did Mars. I did, you know, the rover missions. I did the new discoveries, some of the science that we'll get into tonight.
Right.
But Saturday was my specific political day or night to present my view of the President's Space Initiative and what the nation, what the audience, what the constituency, what this country has to do if they want to see that vision really achieved. And I was told, because of limitations and time and all that, that certain of the staffers would only come and certain of the other people would only come to see me on Saturday. So that's what I devoted to my ostensible political, you know, presentation.
Sure.
I had a call from an intel source. And what he said was, well, we'll have some folks there. You won't see them. So when I stood up to kind of start my speech, I said, well, I've got congressional people here who don't want to be identified. I've got black ops people who don't want to be identified. And if I say something really shocking, don't do anything to give yourself away now. Make sure that you just, you know, maintain a poker face.
If you see someone run out of the room quickly, you'll know that's what they were.
Exactly. You'll know it's one or the other. It was a remarkable phenomenon. And, you know, I'm only giving it to you from my perspective, which is the, you know, 500 plus that came to see what we had to lay out. There were 24 other people from, as I said, those five other countries laying out, you know, Stanton Friedman was his incredible, you know, self.
I call him the father of modern-day ufology. Ever since J. Allen Hynek died,
yes,
I've moved Stanton to the forefront.
Stanton deserves those bars because he's been at it and at it and at it and persistent. And maybe, I don't know when Stanton was born, but like me, he might be a Taurus because we're very, very stubborn. We're persistent.
1820. He and I joke about this.
We are not going to quit till this turns the corner. And it was so ironic because all these people who've been in the field for so long and they've been saying what has to happen and talking about data and the cover-up and the suppression and the, as Stephen so eloquently talks about it, the UFO ghetto. Oh, by the way, you have got to hear his keynote speech. He gave one of the most remarkable encapsulations of where we have come from, where we are now, and where we can go that I have ever heard on this subject. He is also very funny.
I'd like to hear that.
Did you know that Bassett has an incredible... I mean, he should be doing stand-up comedy. He was so funny, but so on point, and so lyrical with the inspiration that has to happen if this is going to be translated from an interesting subject into a movement. And he talked about how close we are to a movement. Well, I can tell you, having now spent a couple of days on the Hill, that we are that close, and I'm holding my fingers a millimeter apart, to this being a movement like the civil rights movement, like, you know, other movements which have transformed American politics that are the hallmark of the American experience, when if enough people get mad enough and decide they want change, change cannot be stood in the way of.
Now, Richard, most of the participants who were at the X conference were people and individuals who have done heavy research into visitations by extraterrestrials. I mean,
yep.
Most of them have been, if not all of them. You are one of the few exceptions who was at a major X conference. In your presentation was more on a scientific plane and a political plane of what was going on. Now, but here's the question.
Okay.
Why have you haven't, I'm not going to say you've distanced yourself from the ufologists, the people who believe that UFOs have landed on this planet and things like that, but that's not you. So what were you doing in this mix?
I don't do UFOs. I've said that over and over and over again. I've said it when I did my first show with Art. I'm not a UFO person. I don't do UFOs. I am doing the science of exoarchaeology. What Bassett put together was a conclave of people who were a mix of current ET exo visitations, and an archaeology perspective, which is what we've been doing, looking at ruins, looking at evidence of, you know, former times on planet Earth, potential previous civilizations connected to what's going on out there in the galaxy. This was the time and place to bring these two ideas together, because if we're right, and I say that, you know, in all humility, because nothing can ever be proven 100% until you have ground truth. But if we're right, if there are ruins tonight on Mars and the Moon, and we live in a solar system of extraordinary technological wonders now in decay because we're in a new era, and that's the past, and we're looking at a future, then by itself that statement says there was more in heaven and earth ratio than dreamed of in your philosophy, that there are other guys out there. Now, I've been looking at the other guys in times past. These other researchers have been looking at the other guys right now.
Right.
The reason I believe firmly, committedly, NASA and the government, the Air Force and the Black Ops people and the intelligence community and Brookings and all of these institutional authority figures have been saying to all the UFO people, you guys are nuts, is because if they were to admit that there was even one ruin, one building, one glass thing on the Moon or Mars or elsewhere, then it opens the doorway to the idea that they weren't just here a long, long time ago in a solar system far, far away. They're here right now.
In a doorway, more like a floodgate, Richard.
It would become a floodgate. Now, let me tell you the corollary. This extends to the concept of exobiology, which is not aliens, intelligence, extraterrestrials, but just other living things.
Mm-hmm.
If the officialdom were to admit that there had been discovered even a microbe on Mars, that doorway opens, because suddenly, if it's independent of Earth origin and evolution, you have two planets in the same solar system which have life that has sprung up separately. And as Sagan told me over and over again, obviously before he died, you know, if Mars has life independent of the Earth, it means the galaxy is teeming with life. And if it's teeming with life, it means it's billions and billions of years older than we are. And that means it has time to develop a science and technology which makes current physics and technology obsolete. No one's going to use rockets to get here. They'll use all kinds of other modalities because they will have had time to figure it out. And that means the UFO thing, again, is right front and center on your doorstep. It becomes legitimized. It becomes scientific. It becomes real.
Precisely.
So all of this had to stay in the ghetto, and we are probably months away, George, from a major breakthrough in this whole paradigm. Stephen's going to have to reset his paradigm clock because it's going to get very close to midnight very quickly. And we came from a meeting tonight at the National Press Club with some key people who are part of what we're doing here in town that has unveiled some additional information which would have me move that time frame even closer to now, provided this constituency, this audience listening all over the world to my voice right now, does what we need them to do, and we're going to tell them what they can do over the rest of the evening.
And when we come back, Richard, as you know, there are a lot of people now beginning to wonder that maybe some of those artifacts, maybe some of the other objects that the rovers are stumbling across on Mars could be fossils. Those are your theories many, many months ago, many years ago in some cases. We'll be back in a moment with Richard C. Hoagland.
Subscribe to the After Dark newsletter and reserve your free CD of Art Bell and the late Father Malachi Martin. 888-727-5505.
Well, Richard, see, before we get really into the issues at hand tonight on the program, I wanted to give you sort of a little birthday present. This came to be. Mark Beal owns a company in Belleville, Illinois, called Acuity Soundworks, and he produced a CD, and one of them, in honor of you, is called Cydonia. I want to play just a short version of it. It's an instrumental, Richard. It runs well over 6 minutes. I'm only going to play about a minute's worth for you, and then we'll get you the CD. If you don't already have it, because I think Mark might be sending one your way. So you ready to listen?
I sure am.
Here you go. This is for your birthday, and it's a very well-produced instrumental called Cydonia. Richard, you should hear that full instrumental with your stereo speakers full blast.
Oh, but, I can't wait.
But let me tell you something that which goes along with that, of course, is your dedication to really this subject matter. It has touched so many other people around this planet. And, you know, that's his small way of just saying thank you. So
now,
happy birthday to you.
Is this from Mark Duane?
No, Mark Beal. Is
Mark Beal.
And he's out of Belleville, Illinois, and he put this together. He has a number of different versions and cuts on his CD, but this one named after Cydonia in honor of you, my friend.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that nothing happens in this society unless it becomes part of the culture. And many years ago, when I wrote Monuments, I got a very interesting letter, because that was, this is like pre-email, okay? I was living in Virginia at the time. I was living on a farm, and Monuments had just been published, and I got this letter from a composer in Ohio named Mark Duane. And he said, I'm working on some music. I read your book. And I'm really overwhelmed by, you know, what you've laid out and what you found and the implications. And I'd like to send you a tape. So I wrote him back, or maybe I called him because I think he included his phone number. And I said, oh, by all means, you know, send it to me. And I give him an address.
Mm-hmm.
A few days later, the tape came in. And he had a few cuts called The Pyramids of Mars. And I listened to it, and it was phenomenal. He had captured what I felt was the essence, the ineffable essence of mystery around what we're dealing with. If we're looking at an ancient civilization, particularly if it's somehow connected to us, as I've said so many times, if we're the Martians,
mm-hmm.
ultimately, Mark had somehow captured what it would be like to live in that realm of speculation on the verge of scientific verification. So I called him up and I said, oh my God, this is amazing. This is great. I said, I wished I'd had this to listen to when I was writing the book. And I said, I have one little suggestion. What about you changing the title and calling it The Monuments of Mars, The Music? Which he did.
Perfect.
And he published it, and it's been in Billboard, and it's been played on radio stations. And of course, now its time has come. So what we might do is to amalgamate, you know, a number of different composers who over the years have had the inspiration to creativity impelled by this science. In fact, I've often told people that I think I have the only scientific bestseller that has ever had an album written to it.
I love it. Hey, by the way, I was listening to Art this weekend. You've been busy. Give him a call.
Okay,
just give him a call. You
is
need
he
to...
willing to talk about artifacts on Mars?
Oh, I don't know, but he just said he hadn't heard from you in a while, and it's time for you two to break bread.
Well, sometimes when you're running at warp 9,
I know,
it's hard to drop below light speed and to you know, open hailing frequencies,
sure.
I will do that.
Absolutely. Anyway, I had a chance today to get on your website, as I have been during the entire week, but I read the entire article, Methane on Mars, that you wrote. And let me tell you, it is one of the most comprehensive articles I have ever seen anywhere in scientific journals, you name it. I'm telling you, Richard, after reading Methane on Mars or Back to the Future, I was convinced before, but I am so convinced that there's some fossils on Mars and that there may be plant life and other vegetation on Mars. I downloaded the whole thing, and I can't put it down. Good job.
Thank you, my friend.
Good job.
We are at a cusp. We are at an inflection point in history, and I don't want to overstate this, but given the implications of what's out there, you know, quoting Chris Carter, the truth is somewhere out there. I am watching these data points fall into place, and I'm watching the politics fall into place, and I'm watching this convergence of the science, the political, whatever's going on within NASA, and the demands of the people to know the truth, and the timetable, whatever that timetable is that these guys have been sitting on, where we don't get to know certain things till next Tuesday. It seems to all be moving now toward a critical moment when there will be an announcement, and the announcement seems to be, yes, there is current life on Mars. Not big guys, not dinosaurs, not ducks, not platypuses, but little guys, little inoffensive microbes that can't hold ray guns, that don't really threaten us, but it's there.
Do you think this announcement is different from what some of the other people who are at the X conference want? They probably want that there are UFOs visiting us and we're going to disclose that. So when you talk about disclosure, Richard, are we talking about what you just mentioned, or are we talking about we've been visited, friends?
This is my favorite disagreement with my dear friend Stephen. You know, I know he put a tremendous amount of energy and effort and all that into the X conference on the theme of aliens are here right now. I do not see the president sitting in the Oval Office saying, my fellow Americans, and then, you know, bringing out, you know, a little guy with big eyes and a bulging head. I do see an announcement before the election, and I'll lay out specifically why I picked that time frame. I do see an announcement from NASA, probably, that there is current microbial life on Mars, and I see it for several specific reasons. One is the data that we've had over the last couple, 3 months, since the rover missions began and since the European Mars Express mission went into orbit, have been bang, 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 creating a much more livable, much more inviting, much more biologically friendly Mars than we have ever had scientifically corroborated. You would agree, right?
I would agree, and I think that alone is a startling revelation if they announce that. Because to admit, and I'm not talking about the meteor where they said maybe it is, and other scientists say it, no, it's probably Earth contamination. I'm exactly with what you've just said. If they can admit that there's some kind of life on Mars, to me, that's one of the greatest stories of all mankind.
Now, if they announce that there are current living systems, even if they're just microbes, what I wrote in the three-parter, the methane paper that we wrote before I left for the conference, is that going to have a shattering effect on the intellectual intelligentsia of the world, on major media, on the political structure, and on the body politic, and most of all, of course, on this audience, all you guys out there tonight who've been following this story. It will vindicate for every one of your family and neighbors and friends and cousins and coworkers who think you're nuts. Suddenly you can get this very self-satisfied look on your face, and you can simply look at them and say, I told you so. Because, as Carl said to me over and over again, Dick, if there's much as a microbe on Mars, independently evolved, it means the galaxy and galaxies, billions and billions, are teeming with life, including intelligence. So by the same token that we said a half hour ago that NASA has ruthlessly suppressed any discussion of current life anywhere except Earth, if that admission comes in the next few months, that doorway is flung open. Your floodgates, George, are suddenly inundated with all the other implications of other life in the universe besides here on planet Earth. And along for the ride come every potential science fiction story you've ever read.
Absolutely.
Every movie you've ever been to, every X-Files episode you ever watched, every Star Trek you ever savored over, every Star Wars you ever went back and saw 385 times. In other words, it all comes rushing through that doorway, and all bets are off. And the ultimate endpoint of that path is going to be, they're here.
I have not had the opportunity to do a program with you about Cydonia. So that's something we need to do in the future,
yes.
Almost a recap, because, again, so much has gone on in the years since with that, and, of course, with the Mars Express up there now, the European satellite, it's possible you're going to get some other pictures there.
Well, you know, one of the things that was so interesting, and you asked before why I showed up at a, quote, UFO event, is because it's time to bring these two
together.
Universes together. And the kind of fulcrum was and is Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, a few weeks ago, when the Mars Express mission took its first high-resolution color images of the Gusev crater, and that's part of the story. It's part of the methane story that we wrote and put on the web a couple days ago. She really got a scoop because she saw these pictures. She put them on her site. We have links to earthfiles.com through Enterprise Tonight. The picture showed in color an exquisite green something down there with the rover marked with an X right in the middle of the picture. And she got a quote from the director of operations for the European Space Agency in Germany, basically saying, I'm going to paraphrase, well, it looks like algae to me.
It looked like algae to me, too.
Yep. And that's a remarkable crossover because, as you know, Linda has done seminal work in ufology, in cattle mutilations, in all the things that go bump in the night. And the fact that she can do the hard science stuff simultaneous with the woo-woo stuff, as seen by a lot of the mainstream, is in one sense an exquisite example of what Stephen pulled off in the contract.
Absolutely, because Linda has been able to balance that and bring it home in a very hard news twist.
Yep.
And she, you know, she doesn't fool around. I mean, she's a bulldog on a story. And, you know, there have been times she and I have talked about an issue, a story. Maybe I'm not interested in it. Maybe she is. And I'm telling you, she's relentless.
We were so rushed. I mean, it's one of these things where you see all kinds of people that you haven't seen in years, and you kind of pass them at warp 5,
right?
And you wave to them in the halls as you're dashing for one. I mean, Stephen did a good job of trying to keep it multi-track so people could actually see a lot of everything, but there's no way you can have that many people presenting that much new information with that much import and have even a possibility of getting it all simultaneously.
Oh, you can't. And you're worried about your own presentation.
Exactly.
You've got to get that
done. So, Linda and I only had a chance to kind of get together the last night at the Dead Dog Party. Do you like that term?
Yeah, I do. And by the way, she's going to be here tomorrow and Friday.
Excellent.
So
we only had a chance to touch base briefly up in Stephen's, you know, conference suite at the very end of the night.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because we have not talked probably in 4 or 5 years.
That long?
That long. Well, there's just too much to do. It's like me talking to Art.
Yeah.
Not because I don't like talking to Art. It's because you have to drop below warp speed to do that kind of stuff.
And as
this quickening curve accelerates, do you like that little segue?
You and Art are like brothers, for crying out loud.
As this quickening accelerates, there's less and less time to ponder where it is we are going. So we only had a moment to talk at this little get-together, but what was stunning to me is how independent from her sources she had exactly the same timetable that something is coming very soon on this Mars biology, living things there now front, and it would be the wedge that opens the door.
It may be the next major announcement.
I think it will be the next major announcement. Now, Let me back up and do a commercial, all right?
For you or for me? If it's me, I got to fax you the copy.
For the political process.
Okay.
I've said over and over and over again that this process requires funds, requires money. Without money, without funds, you ain't got a political campaign. We are in the midst of the most important campaign, bar none, and I'm even excluding the current election, because what happens in this campaign, the disclosure campaign, will change the context of everything, including Iraq, including bin Laden, including the war on terror, including only one planet, including are we alone, do we have brothers, what's our relationship to God, the universe. I mean, everything changes, as Brookings said 40, 50 years ago, if we're not alone. So here's the commercial. Steve produced a miracle in this conference, but he requires you to complete the process, which is to get a set of the videos for all you folks who missed what was going on. You have the extraordinary luxury that we did not. We couldn't see each other's stuff because we were busy worrying about our own stuff or worrying about people who came up to have us sign books or talk to them or debrief them or do little things like have lunch. You can sit in the luxury of your home tonight. You can go to the web. You can go to a website I'm about to give you, and you can order the tapes and DVDs of the entire conference so you get a perspective before the curtain falls of what is about to happen. You can see everyone and what they saw and what they put out and what they presented and where their thoughts are right now as to the threshold that we're on. And I would strongly recommend, if you want to be ahead of the curve, that you do that. And if you do that, a part of these proceeds, you know, past the expenses, will go to provide the elixir of political campaigns, which is dollars, to continue the fight, to continue the process, to let us all go on and to do the next parts of the campaign that have to be done, the follow-through. Because without follow-through, one conference is not going to make a difference.
Well, and let me tell you, that's fair enough, because I'm told that the guests, including, of course, some of the people that a lot of people might not know of, did a magnificent job there. And this is something you can keep forever.
So, pencil and paper is ready, everybody? You want to write, this is not going to be the X conference website, because Steve, frankly, is
do it fast. We got 30 seconds to get the website out.
Okay. You want to go to www.lostartsmedia.com. www.lostartsmedia.com, all one word, lowercase. And on the upper left-hand corner of that, you'll see a big thing that says Paradigm Research Group proudly presents the X Conference. DVD and videotapes are now available. Click here.
You got it. Back with more. I've got to ask you about that algae when we come right back, Richard.
Reserve your free CD of Art Bell and Malachi Martin when you subscribe to After Dark. Call toll-free 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505.
Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Richard C. Hoagland, our guest for the entire Coast to Coast program. Hey, Richard, how would you like to give someone the thrill of a lifetime who is probably one of your staunchest supporters? You know, you've got millions of them here with the Coast to Coast family, those who listen on Streamlink Radio, but you've also got a fellow by the name of Bad Boy from the Fantastic Forum who just thinks the world of you. I know this. Tell him hi for me.
Oh, hi there, Bad Boy. You know, we had some Fantastic Forum people actually show up, and they said, you know, they told me just what you said, that these guys are following what we're doing, and they're looking at the data, and they're, you know, working as we are to try to get this stuff out. And, you know, electronically, this is so important, George, because we may be fewer in numbers, you know, than the other side sometimes, you know, the ones behind the scenes, the black ops guys. But we have better electronics, I think.
Indeed. Were you always a believer of some kind of life on Mars, or did you change over the years?
Well, I think the data has changed me. I mean, I grew up reading, you know, Asimov and Heinlein, and then I got to know them, which, of course, was incredible. Ray Bradbury's, you know, novel, the collection of short stories, you know, the Martian Chronicles,
sure,
were incredibly powerful for me because it was back in the 50s, you know, when I was beginning to read science fiction and going to school and learning, you know, as we all do, how the world works. The idea that we would go to Mars and find the human race ourselves, which was the heart of Bradbury's tale, was just shocking. It was absolutely the most mind-blowing idea one could imagine. But the even more mind-blowing idea was that decades later, we'd send spacecraft to Mars, officially from the government, supported by American taxpayers, and take a picture of a human face on Mars, which indicated we'd found ourselves. I mean, that is, as I wrote in Monuments, that to me is the most stunning, startling aspect of all of this, because it's also the showstopper. It's also the one major problem that has kept this in the closet, in the dark, able to be suppressed by government and forces that don't want us to know, because of all the gin joints in all the world, you know, as the Casablanca line goes, you would never imagine that you'd go to another planet, an alien planet, and meet yourself.
Well, what's so fantastic, too, is everything that's even happening now, and even the possibility of disclosure of microbial life or any other kind of life on Mars, it all kinds of leads back to Cydonia, or the theory that you have given us over the years that, indeed, there was an advanced civilization on that planet.
But not just any old advanced civilization, George. The face became both the biggest signal that something profound was going on and the biggest problem to taking it seriously at a scientific level. Because as we laid out at the Wisconsin conference, the God, Man, and ET conference, which, by the way, those tapes, when we get back to Mexico, those tapes are within a whisker of finally being edited. And we'll be able to deliver them to all the people that have ordered them and all the people through this audience that are wanting to order them. And the central thing we grappled with for that weekend, that day of the conference, was how can we have, either in a traditional creationist paradigm or a traditional scientific paradigm, a human-looking face on an alien world if God only created the human race here or if evolution only would create us here. And solving that problem is going to be the mind blower of the 21st century. And as I've been saying all night, it looks like its time is rapidly coming where we're going to finally get some answers if the projections of the politics of this are anywhere close to being real.
Well, what gives your theories some credence and credibility is that if they announce that they have life there, to me, you know, if Cydonia, if it were sitting out there all by itself, and they went there and they never found the water, they never found life, we never knew about that, but all we did is we heard your theories of Cydonia and the possibilities of what could be there. Wonderful, marvelous, and would never know unless we go there. But now, with the possibility, the real possibility, that this planet had water, that this planet might have had some real life there, then it makes you wonder, quite frankly, for me, that your theories that you have talked about over the years, I mean, you're the one who had the tidal theory, you're the one who talked about all these other things, who's to say then that this other theory, the most magnificent of the entire bunch, the possibility of life evolving there and possibly coming here, who's to say that's not true? I mean, that's what's exciting for me.
Well, you know, as I said on Sunday night, Steve Bassett got up with Cheryl Jones. By the way, Cheryl Jones, who was the co-MC of the conference, says hi.
Great.
And you really missed, I mean, a really cool time hanging out with Cheryl. In fact, Steve and Cheryl were so interesting in introducing the various presenters that we're actually thinking of putting them both on the road as the Steve and Cheryl show.
Well, but she's a good news person.
As part of my Sunday night presentation, I laid out this scenario that we would get there and find out that this was true and that was true and that was true. All the things I've been saying all the years, you know, I kind of talked about how I seem to be on a roll because all the things that have been unveiled by NASA in the last few weeks, we had predicted specifically in writing years ago.
I want you to put on your writer's hat for a moment and put in the real science that you've been known for, too. Tell us for a moment, Richard, from the moment we launch a manned crew to Mars, just tell us where you think they'd go, what they'd see when the door opens, the hatch opens, and put them out there on the planet. I'd like to just hear this from you.
Well, if I was made, and I want to make an announcement in the next hour, a very important announcement, because in order to get to a manned mission, George, as I said on Saturday night at the conference, I think we need to do something radically different politically. So I'll save my recommendation for how we get to the manned mission for then, but let me tell you what has to happen for it to succeed. The first thing you have to do is to decide to send men and women and the right technology to go there and verify a whole bunch of stuff.
Have we done that yet?
No.
Okay.
Of course not. You know, we sent robots. Unfortunately, we seem to be on the official track sending robots that are only designed to look at one or two things. Remember Linda's critical question?
Oh, yes.
Inquired,
yes.
You know, can you measure organics?
And he kept saying no. No,
and I don't want to even talk about it. And he got really pissed with her. Well, I complimented her on really pissing him off, because that's how you find out real data these days.
Use a different word for
rattled.
Me. Use a different word for me, by the
oh,
way.
Oh, thank you.
Okay?
Thank you. Okay.
I don't want to keep bleeping you.
Disturbed.
Okay.
How's that?
That's good.
Anyway.
I'm such a
saint. So where would we go to crack this wide open? Well, there's obviously only one place to go. Cydonia.
Yep.
Cydonia is the place that has the secrets. And it has, in our model, the one thing that if you didn't know any of this stuff, if you really just walked up on Mars on a summer night with an expedition, and were orbiting the planet, deciding where to land, Captain Kirk, and you looked down on sensors and you saw the face on Mars, that's the place you'd want to land. For the obvious reason is it shouldn't exist.
Exactly.
It's a huge oopah.
Might that be the only region on the planet that had intelligent life?
No, not at all.
Okay.
No, we are looking, I mean, we've now looked at a database of Mars Surveyor imagery, at Mars Odyssey imagery. We're now looking at Mars Express imagery. There's artifacts and artificial stuff all over the planet, not counting the artifacts that we saw all around the Spirit lander, Art, are you listening, when we landed a few months ago. So it was a global civilization. The thing that makes Cydonia unique is that it's the one place where we have a mile-long, 1,500-foot-high statue that looks like us. And as I said on CNN and NBC and CBS and my arguments with Squires on Charlie Rose, you know, decades ago, if you were going to get someone's curiosity coming from the third planet, landing on the fourth, the one guaranteed way to do a come hither, to point out where to land for the good stuff, the secrets, the missing puzzle pieces, the data that would put it all together, the archives, the libraries, George, are going to be at Cydonia, in that city, and maybe in archives under the face itself. So there's only one place to land with a human expedition, and that's Cydonia.
Can you get close to those artifacts?
Well, if we're right about the model that there was this flourishing civilization and incredible extensive biosphere, like on Earth, on Mars, and the scientific data tonight is so close to confirming that. I mean, the methane, George, is telling us that there probably was an incredibly extensive biosphere on Mars which almost died.
Exactly, almost died. Because what I have heard is that it regenerates every 300 years. Something's regenerating.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Because methane goes away. It's destroyed by oxygen and CO2 and sunlight. Unless there's something that's replenishing it, there should be none in the atmosphere. Methane is an indicator of an active biology, as James Lovick said, a chemical disequilibrium indicative of living things. Now, the big question is, are there current little guys, microbes, methanogens they're called, spewing out little bits of methane now, eking out a barely survival existence on a desert glaciated Mars? Or are we seeing natural methane? Are we seeing evidence of methane from volcanic sources?
But they haven't seen a volcano erupt.
There isn't a volcano in sight.
Right.
Now, Colin Pillinger, who was the principal scientist on the missing Beagle 2 lander. Remember, the Mars Express mission had two components.
Right.
Had the orbiting mothership, Mars Express, currently in orbit tonight, taking stunning data. It also had the little Beagle 2 lander.
That they never heard from.
That disappeared after 5 days before it was supposed to land. Mm-hmm. They left it off from the spacecraft. It was heading toward Mars, never heard from again. In that spacecraft, Pillinger had one key experiment designed to measure methane. And the experiment was looking for methane for the obvious reason that methane says life.
Yep.
If you measure isotopes of methane, methane is carbon and hydrogen, CH4. It's one carbon atom surrounded by four hydrogen atoms. But the atoms come in different weights. Those are called isotopes. The heavy weight of carbon is carbon-13. The average normal weight that we're familiar with is carbon-12. Well, for some reason, not yet understood by biologists, life seems to overwhelmingly prefer carbon-12 to carbon-13. So if you look at sources of methane on a planet like the Earth, and it's naturally produced by hot rocks and carbon dioxide and water and all that, you'll have a lot more carbon-13 in the methane than if it comes from biology, from microbes or cows or...
Or people.
Or people, exactly, yes.
Yeah.
There are things I can't say on the radio, but you can use your imagination. So if the methane on Mars was biological, as Pillinger pointed out in the London Telegraph a few weeks ago, it will give itself away by having a preponderance of the carbon-12 isotope. Well, his gadget on Beagle 2 was designed to measure the isotope differences in any methane they found. Isn't it a shame, a tragedy, that instrument and that spacecraft disappeared? Because tonight, not only could we know that there was methane on Mars, but we could have unequivocal evidence that it was from living systems. But by analogy, Pillinger said in this article in the Telegraph a few days ago, that since most of the methane on Earth in the atmosphere is from biological sources, either current living things or from buried oil and gas, you know, biomass that's been compressed into hydrocarbon fuels. Millions of years, it is more than likely that the methane that we're seeing on Mars is either from current life or past, now extinct life, meaning that if it's from ancient extinct life seeping up through the ground, you know, ancient Martian dinosaurs, so to speak,
sure,
it means that Mars had this incredible diverse biosphere, because at a geologically dead planet, to get the methane we're seeing leaking out requires there to be an enormous amount of buried biomass underground, George.
And whether it was current or past,
it
doesn't
still
matter.
Living at one time.
Exactly.
So that's the incredible breakthrough that we're poised. And you said it, you called it a few minutes ago. You said the next data point has got to be the announcement there's life there now. And I 100% agree with you. And that's the event we're projecting for October. Now, come back to Cydonia. If the biosphere model is correct, if the tidal model and a prolific Mars and 500 million years of evolution on Mars, companions that are here on Earth, if that's all real, it means intelligence was probably part of the mix. How do we know that? We've got the artifacts. But now we've got artifacts plus context. You see, we've been arguing all these years, kind of like lonely voices in the wilderness, hey, look at that face. Look at those pyramids. Look at those tunnels.
Sure.
Look at those things. And scientists have been saying to us out of NASA with a sneer, well, there's no way you could have life on Mars. It's too cold. It's too frigid. It's too desiccated. There's no water. There's no air. There's, you know, all the can't happen. But if you have living things still there eking out an existence from a much prolific former living planet, then the intelligence aspect, the artifacts, suddenly take on a total life of their own, pun intended.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it gives it the credence and credibility
exactly.
that you need.
And it becomes science, not science fiction, and all bets are off, and that's why you got to get these tapes.
Now,
here's enough
of the commercial for a while, Hoagland. How do you know that beans didn't come from another area of this universe, go to Mars, then come here? Or how do you know that we didn't have a past advanced civilization that left here and went to Mars?
That's all the models and monuments. That's the three main scenarios, and you're right. You're absolutely right, George. We do not. That's why we require a human expedition as rapidly as possible to go find out. Because two of those three scenarios, the intelligence came from some other star system, came to Mars
mm-hmm.
and came to Earth,
mm-hmm.
and meddled in the nursery, affects the origin and destiny of the human species at a fundamental level. It puts Genesis in a whole new context, as we said at this conference in Wisconsin. It makes the concept of God created man in his own image a totally new realm.
I would, the kid in me, Richard, would prefer the first two scenarios, that either beings came from another part of this universe or they came directly from Mars. I would be somewhat disappointed if we found out that it was us from a long time ago that went to Mars.
But remember, Mr. Scott, it's a big universe and billions of years for things to have happened. Even if we find, if we go to Mars and we find that it's us, it's our great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers, that does not explain the abrupt, sudden appearance of life on Earth itself. Because life was, you know, going along
well,
at no more than
true.
A microbial level.
That's true.
And then one day at the Precambrian, we had what's called the Precambrian explosion, where all the diverse genus and families and species and subspecies that we are currently familiar with exploded onto the scene, left all kinds of fossils in the geological record, and all the current living species are descended from this explosion of life about 600 million years ago. The question is, what caused that explosion of life? One model that I have been quietly working on, and we're not yet ready to publish, but it looks as if there is evidence, really important evidence, to support the idea that up until about 600 million years ago, this solar system was not fit for complex living things, living beings. And then one day, something was changed. Things were rearranged. What was previously inhospitable for intelligence and other diverse species suddenly became de rigueur, suddenly became almost inevitable. Was that because of the intervention of God, or was it the intervention of an alien species moving through the galaxy like gardeners planting seeds for fruition down the line?
Well, let's find out a little bit more about that when we come back.
Would you pay 15 cents to hear this show in its entirety? That's the daily charge for StreamLink. Sign up at www.coasttocoastam.com.
Richard, you remind me a little bit of Zechariah Sitchin, he being a professional in his own right, analyzing Sumerian texts, coming up with really some incredible theories based on what he believes are out there. And then what you do, analyzing data and information and putting together your theories. And it all seems, as you were saying earlier, a couple hours ago, it all seems to be coming together to form one major mission, and that is life on Earth and life elsewhere in this universe. It's incredible stories.
You know, we are so close, I believe, to having final, definitive knowledge and answers and not have to live with speculation. This could have happened, that could have happened, this scenario, that scenario. I mean, I've known Sitchin for a very long time. In fact, when our work was first highlighted by the Associated Press back in, it's so long ago, 1985, I believe, I got my first letter from Zach Sitchin. And he pointed out that our estimate of the time frame for this happening on Mars within the last half million years, 300 and some, yeah, half million years, was very, very close to his estimate based on his reading of the Sumerian text of 450,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's 50,000 years among friends?
That's right.
So that was the beginning of our conversation. And over the years, you know, we've had our points of agreement and our points of disagreement. And you see, disagreement is not bad, because none of us have enough data to absolutely be able to tell everyone tonight this is the way it happened.
That's
true.
There's
no way we can say this is the way it happened. But we're getting closer to where we will have assembled the proper political and technological matrix, I'm using that word carefully, to tell us what happened. And, you know, we can start making, you know, little fun side bets. You know, is it going to be this? Is it going to be that? I mean, I've never talked about the seeding idea before tonight because it wasn't time. There was not the background. But when you're so close to having an official announcement, there is life on Mars. The methane's coming from life. The green stuff is life. The things you want me to talk about in a moment could be big life, trees, bushes.
Yes.
Mars is bushes.
Yes.
Then it's appropriate at that point to take a deep breath, you know, suck it up, and to talk about the next phase, which is how do we put these patterns together in terms of what kind of life, its origin, how it got there, how it evolved, how it affects what's going on here, where here originated, when. In other words, science is continually speculative stuff followed by confirmation of comparing the data against the predictions.
You know, Paul Allen has written a check for $15 million, and he gave it to SETI so they can set up the Paul Allen array of radio telescopes.
Yep.
And I'm not going to tell him what to do with his own money, but you know what? There are some other things, too, that may be able to prove that there's life out there, and he could have spent it in a little different way and maybe didn't have to write a check that big. What do you think?
You know, if you're going to bet on something as far out as the origin and destiny of life in the universe, the prudent thing, like with any other investment, would be to spread the bet. You know, for people to put all their eggs in the NASA basket for a variety of reasons, even if you never heard of us and never heard of our political discussions of cover-ups and hidden data and all that, why would one prudently put all your eggs in that basket when in the history of science and the history of knowledge in the world, it's always been the wild card, the unexpected, the amateurs, the outsiders that have made the real breakthroughs? That's historically totally accurate.
I was going to say, use your money, buy up all the Sumerian texts and give it to experts, but they may be gone anyway.
I was going to say, remember the 80,000 texts that disappeared out of the Baghdad Museum?
I know it. They're gone. Somebody has them.
Somebody's got them tonight.
Anyway, on your website, Methane on Mars or Back to the Future, you have a picture of something that just boggles my mind. And I want to know where that picture came from. Did it come from Mariner, or am I looking at a picture that was from this planet and you're using it as a comparison, but it looks like trees? I mean, many, many trees. Is that a Martian picture, or is that an Earth
Martian picture? That was taken in probably, let me think back. It was taken probably around 1998-99 by the Mars Global Surveyor. It is near the Martian South Pole, and it was first flagged by Arthur C. Clarke, my dear, dear friend in Sri Lanka, half a world away. And he started making a lot of noise about it, you know, asking various NASA scientists at JPL, asking various people, you know, that he knows. Arthur knows everybody, of course. And he could not get an official response to what seemed to be him to be not just life on Mars, but big life. So he likened what's in those pictures to banyan trees. Or we've taken to calling them now Arthur's bushes, because they're like a mile or so across, and they appear to have shadows and three-dimensional form. They have tendrils, and they look like you're looking down at a forest at the South Pole of Mars, to the South Pole.
It's incredible. And you're right, but the shadows I noticed right away when I looked at the picture on your website. I mean, these are objects. If they're going to cast shadows, they're objects. And, you know, they're not sand dunes. They're not crystals of a lot of ice.
No.
They've got texture to them. And probably color. They look like they're dark green.
We don't have any color pictures.
No, I know that, but they look like
colorized versions that various amateur anomalists have done. But there are no real color. Now we would expect from Mars Express that Dr. Newcomb might have taken color, because the spacecraft was in polar orbit and was fairly close to Mars when it passed over the South Pole. So we may have in the Mars Express database hidden images in color of Arthur's bushes, but they have not been published as yet. Also, Mars Odyssey, which is the mission that was named after Arthur C. Clarke's seminal movie, 2001 A Space Odyssey, by the agency, may also have taken images over the South Pole of these things, but they haven't been published yet.
Now, these,
I wonder if we're going to see a lot of green down there.
Well, if these are indeed trees, they're huge trees.
See, what's so important about this is that this discovery, and Arthur making a big noise about it several years ago, came long before the recent Mars Express findings released a few weeks ago, that they had found through the Omega spectrometer an anomalous amount of water and water ice at the South Pole. When Mariner 69, the two Mariner missions I described at the beginning of the methane paper, flew by Mars with me and a few other people as a witness in 69, there was only carbon dioxide ice seen at the South Pole, frozen CO2, mm-hmm. Dry ice. In the intervening period, and this is the really important thing, George, in the intervening period between 1969 and 2004, something has changed on Mars fundamentally, climatologically.
35 years.
35 years. There now is an extraordinary amount of water ice on the top of the CO2 and water vapor hovering over the South Pole when the ice begins to melt.
Is it terraforming itself?
My bet is that the solar system as a whole is going through some kind of extraordinary hyperdimensional spring, which is warming Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Earth, that the idea that global warming is confined only to this world is not true, and there is some huge physics behind a long-term cycle. And we write about this particularly at the end of the third part of the Martian methane paper, and that spring may be coming to Mars again, which would, I mean, what happens in spring on Earth? All kinds of little guys come alive again,
yes,
right?
Yes, they do. I think the sun is getting hotter.
The sun is changing its cycle, but this is a physics that doesn't seem to depend on solar energy. It seems to be inputting energy into various planets from some other place, and my bet is the hyperdimensional model is the explanation for the place. The energy is actually coming from another dimension. It's not coming through the sun. And that's another whole program and another whole paper that we're working on, which we will have, which we'll publish shortly. In fact, I'm working on it with David Wilcox, and I know that David and you have talked in the past.
Yes.
And I want to do a show with David because he is marshaling meticulously all of the evidence from all the science papers written over the last 5-10 years showing that this physics is changing all over the system, And when we get our act together, we want to come on and talk about that evidence because it's critical to what is going to happen here.
How would you handle this phone call? Sean O'Keefe calls you from NASA and says, Richard, we're going to make an announcement in a few days, and we want to fly you up here to Washington, and I want you standing by me. And we're going to make this announcement of life on Mars, and we've got some pictures we want to show you first. And we don't want to disclose them, but we want to show them to you. So Richard C. Hoagland gets on a plane, and he flies out there, and he meets these NASA executives and officials. They shut the door, and they bring out these incredible pictures of Cydonia, pictures that you can only imagine. Maybe doorways leading into where the face was, you know, structures and stuff. And they ask you, Richard, don't say anything, please, but we just want you to know. You've devoted almost your whole life to this. Would you tell us?
Boy, that's a toughie because it has to do with giving your word.
Yep.
If the only way I could get to see the data, and they'd have to tell me beforehand whether I could tell other people or not tell them.
Yeah, they'd even probably have you sign something.
Yeah. If I couldn't tell everybody out there tonight, and I hope, George, you know I absolutely mean this because this is where I have been for the last 20 years on this.
This may be the most perplexing question anybody's ever asked you.
It is. It is. And my immediate reaction is I wouldn't go. Because I'm not in this to find out myself. I am in this to allow everybody to find out because I unequivocally believe that this knowledge, this hidden information that's been depressed and kept from us for so long is essential, is vital to the very survival of the human species. And me knowing about it makes not a tinker's dam. Everybody's got to know so we all can use it to get to where we have to go.
And
so
no,
although intellectually it would be extraordinary, it wouldn't be worth anything. Because if I can't tell everybody and lay out what it means and how we can use it to change our destiny, what's the point?
And knowing you, what you do is you grab the non-disclosure paper, not sign it, post it up on the enterprisemission.com and say, see, I told you, there's something
well,
there.
Well, if I had some interference and I could get out the door with the paper, it would be proof of what I've been saying. There's hidden knowledge that they don't want you to know. But, you know, that's an interesting thought experiment that I don't think is going to be necessary because the political things that are happening here tonight in Washington that are going to happen tomorrow when I get – I mean, keep in mind that I've got to do this show the rest of the night. Then I have to grab a couple hours sleep, get up, be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, go downtown, and have face-to-face meetings with representatives, heavyweights, who represent millions of people and who are interested in what we have to say on this and many other subjects. And that's where we are right now, and it's because of the steadfastness of this audience in huge measure and the consistency of you being behind your right to know.
You know, you've been at this for a long time. When can you even remember when your first program with Art was?
Oh, my gosh. I remember dimly that I was in California. No, I was in Seattle, Washington, I think. And I think it was in the afternoon.
Would it have been 10 years?
It's at least 10 years. It may be 11 or 12.
You may be coming up on an anniversary date.
Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, I think you are pretty soon because a lot of things could happen right around that period. And if you're right about disclosure, this kind of disclosure, that would be kind of a neat thing because
it would be so fitting because of course without Art, you know, we would never have had the capacity to reach people who can make the difference.
Oh, he had the guts to do it, let me tell you. And he stuck his neck out and he pounded away at it. You pounded away at it and some others pounded away at it in their own way, in their own theories. And none of this could happen without one him and without you and what everybody has been doing to get this done.
It's so interesting to compare your two styles. You know, you and I know each other pretty well now, and to me, emotionally, it was kind of rough when Art left because I was so used to having him as a partner in this effort mm-hmm. to be pressing the issue till we finally get the truth. And what I have come to appreciate is, although You have a very different style than Arndt. Your objective is exactly, precisely the same. And you have a few wrinkles up your sleeve that I think you're waiting to unveil yourself.
Well, you know, we're Geminis, Arndt and I.
Yeah.
And that might explain a lot. And I've always thought of this as the three amigos, and I'm the kid brother of the bunch.
Yeah, the three amigos and 20 million of their most intimate friends.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But you're right. I mean, the guts for all of you to do what you did, and I think really for you, Richard, for Arndt, for the people who started this. You know, if I pull that old phrase from the movie Contact, I didn't build it. I think for you folks, that this would be a testament to the efforts that you have undertaken. And just by, again, looking at the X conference and what Stephen Bassett put together with all of you, you know, one day I think you'll all finally get your due. I really do. And I say that in a very positive way.
Well, the cool thing is that as I'm watching this process, the most amazing serendipitous things are happening that one can never plan for. And if we have a few moments here before the break, I want to tell you one little story.
Yeah, yeah. As soon as you hear the music, you know you got about 30
we
seconds.
We were on the Hill yesterday afternoon doing a lot of filming. You know, Cheryl and I and Laurie Hakola, who's my director. You know, we've got all kinds of stuff covered. We're going to go back and furiously edit and put out versions of what we've got so people can see how this process tracks. We're going to, you know, get video tomorrow as we go into some of these meetings so you can actually see they're real congresspeople interested in what you want to know about this, which I find stunningly important, stunningly. So we're out there at sunset filming from the balustrade, the western portico of the Capitol, and I'm describing the Masonic and tetrahedral geometry that Washington and L'Enfant put in the Capitol. I mean, to stand there and look out at the Washington Monument as the sun is grandly setting behind it, it's a pretty amazing view when you know what you're looking at. And we're walking down to go over and have dinner with some folks who we're going to meet, and we see this guy, you know, with his family, kind of gambling on the lawn with this beautiful little blonde girl. She was just the cutest little thing, and he's, you know, dressed in. He obviously was a businessman. He had a pager on. He had a tie. He had his coat off. He's running around and he's throwing. Get this 3-foot flying saucer filled with helium on the lawn of the Capitol of the United States, overlooking the Mall and the Washington Monument. And we're watching this, and of course I said, Lori, get that on film. So we're photographing this, and there's a great shot of this saucer up against the Capitol, like that replay of the 1950s movie Flying Saucers.
Real.
The Invasion of Flying Saucers. Yeah. When we come back, I will tell you who this person turned out to be.
Okay, we'll do that. We'll continue the dialogue with Richard C. Hoagland. We'll take a few phone calls during the hour. So let's be right back.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.
And we're back with Richard C. Hoagland. Okay, Richard, finish your little helium UFO story on the White House, all right?
Well, not the White House.
The Capitol.
On the lawn of the Capitol, on the western lawn, which slopes up from the Mall toward the, you know, all the multiple levels and the porticos and the balconies and all that. You've seen this shot on TV a million times, all right? So this is sunset, close to sunset, and there's this family. You know, a lot of tourists and buses and Japanese tourists with cameras and, you know, policemen, lots of policemen on motorcycles and bicycles riding around you know, for the security.
Oh, sure. Things
have
changed.
They won't let you up on the upper levels of the Western Portico now because of the security situation.
Sure.
But on this lawn, this expansive sloping green lawn, huge lawn in front of the fountains between the Capitol and the mall, there's this family gambling around. This one guy with his little daughter, little golden-haired daughter, and there's two women that are kind of standing by the fence looking out, and he's running around throwing this huge, it looked like a huge inflated Frisbee, except it was a flying saucer covered with decals of aliens. So, of course, I said, Lori, get that shot. I mean, this is just too cool, right? So we go over and we start talking with the woman, who's his wife, it turns out, and then he comes over to the fence and he introduces himself and he says, my name, and I can't tell you his name, but he says, my name is so-and-so, and I'm here with my daughter. You know, we just bought this, you know, over in, I forget, one little village around Washington, they bought it. And he said, I just got off from voting.
From voting?
From voting.
Voting for what?
Well, I looked at Robin, and I looked at Lori, and I thought, uh-oh. So he then gave me his name, and then he runs out in this field, and he's throwing this thing around, and she's throwing it around. So she tosses it up in the air, and the wind catches it. And it's drifting toward the trees, and I'm running down the sidewalk, this broad esplanade toward the Capitol, and I leap in the air, and I catch this thing before it lands on this fence.
This dramatic vision I'm seeing of you leaping.
It's all on video. You know, it's like if a tree falls in the forest and CNN isn't there to capture it, does it really fall?
Yeah, true.
Well, you've now got Hoagland with a flying saucer in front of the Capitol of the United States. It turned out that this was a key member of Congress with his family.
I would have thought that.
Playing with his daughter who'd just gotten this thing. And I said, I introduced myself, and I said, I'm here to support the President's Space Initiative. Would you have a few minutes to talk in the next couple of days? And his face lit up, George. It's like, oh, he says, I would do anything to support this. He says, we haven't had this kind of vision in the space program since John Kennedy.
Did he know who you were?
His wife said that I looked familiar. He did not know, gave him my card. He is one of our key meetings tomorrow morning.
No cancellation yet, huh?
He is what?
No cancellation here.
Oh, no. He is a key member of a key committee, and that's all I can say right now because these meetings are private until the members want to go public. But we have a roster of probably a dozen key people that in the last 24 hours have decided to meet with us on these issues that we've been discussing tonight, the full range from Cydonia to extraterrestrial technology to black ops to suppression of data by a taxpayer-supported agency, et cetera. So
you're going to tell them all that? And you're going to sit down with this member of Congress,
yep,
and just lay it right out there?
Lay it right out, because it was in the briefing memo sent around by some of our key supporters inside as part of the preparation, and they agreed to the meetings. George, that's why I say the wind is changing, and it's because, as I've said over and over again, that comes down to numbers. It comes down to their perception that the American people want to know, and over the years we've asked this audience to express their sentiments, to send messages to John McCain and other senators and congressmen.
It's worked.
It is working, and the most serendipitous thing was to meet this individual, this member of the House, in that way. And tomorrow, when I can tell him the rest of the story, it'll be very intriguing to see what happens.
Remember, there are no coincidences.
I keep thinking about that, all right? Now, we won't go there. Until we have the meetings, I can't go much further. I do want to say one critical thing. I want to make one specific proposal tonight where we need this constituency, this audience, to make their voices heard. Because one of the things that I'm going to ask for when I have these meetings tomorrow and the next day, I'm going to ask that these congressmen support me in my effort to get in front of the President's Space Commission in their last hearing in New York on the week of May 3rd and 4th at the Asia Society in New York City.
That's coming up, Richard.
It's coming up in less than a couple of weeks, okay? What I need is for everyone who cares, who has followed this process, to go to the Presidential Commission website tonight, which is www.moontomars.org.
Moon to Mars.
www.moontomars.org.
Okay.
And on there you will see a website connection. moontomars.org/notices/contact, ASP. It's all clickable. Just go to the web and you can click on it. What you need to do if you want to hear the proposal that I'm going to make to these congressmen and have it in front of the President's Commission, which is deciding how the Moon to Mars initiative will be proceeded in the next 5, 10, 20 years, you need to get us in that chair testifying. And it can only happen if they invite us. And they will only invite us if they get lots and lots of email demanding that our view and our data be presented to the commission. So this is the specific thing tonight that you can all do to move this process along. Now let me tell you, you know, first, what I told the conference, the X conference, on Saturday night before I actually get a chance to tell the commission. I am very concerned that the president's vision is going to be stillborn, that it's going to die a kind of a lingering death for lack of support.
Well, it's also too far out.
That's one of the problems. Yeah. The main issue that has come up again and again and again in all these hearings that have been held since January when the president announced this resumption of the Real Space Program, which we should have had 30 years ago, and I spent 2 hours laying out in the conference, what the key item that's missing is something called sustainability. How do you maintain interest and public support over 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 administrations and dozens of congressional terms and senatorial terms? We have never attempted, George, in this country, in this society, to maintain a public work, a public infrastructure on that time scale over so many alternating administrations. I mean, you can't depend on the politics of Republicans or Democrats or independents to be consistent from administration to administration, let alone from decade to decade.
Oh, that's true.
So I have been thinking long and hard, if we really want this to happen, if we really want the space program we deserve, if we really want them to go back to the moon and find the artifacts that are there and go to Mars and discover the meaning of the artifacts that are there, and if there really is the life that we believe that gave breath to the civilizations that we see in the NASA data, it's going to require a radical institutional change. So what I want to do is I want to be called to testify in front of the commission, and I want to give them what I believe to be a new perspective on how to make this work, which involves the American people from the ground up.
Who initiates the response to you to get you on that committee to speak?
I'm going to be asking these congressmen to help. But the main thing I was told over and over again, particularly tonight in our meeting at the National Press Club with some of the people that came down the hill to talk to us in a kind of a neutral territory,
mm-hmm.
It's got to be people.
Okay.
If people to make it so, like Picard, it will be made so. You have no idea, George, and everyone listening, how powerful individual people can be. We were told, and I'm going to lay out the specifics of this in the next few weeks, we were told how important members are to their constituents. How when a constituent comes to Washington, get this, if you walk in off the street here in Washington to go to see your representative, they have to see you.
Or somebody does.
They will take the meeting, exactly.
Somebody
or they will
does.
Delegate a key member of their staff to meet with you to sit down and discuss your concerns.
Yep.
It's incredibly powerful.
As soon as you show them where you live,
yep.
Then
you
go.
That is a key part of this equation in a world which has become so jaded politically, where we don't think our voices count. I can tell you with first-person experience tonight on Capitol Hill, That's not so if you get involved. So let me tell you how to get involved. You need to go to that website, www.moontomars.org. Click on the section, and you'll see it. It's right in the middle of the page, where they ask for anyone can submit written statement to the commission, and you request that the Enterprise mission be called to officially testify on the sustainability issue on the President's Space Initiative to present our data and our ideas. And this is the idea, George. I propose on Saturday night, and I intend to propose to the commission and to the congressman we see in the next couple of days, that NASA be subsumed into a larger institution. That what's required now, given that we're looking at, in essence, the colonization of the solar system as the long-term mandate mm-hmm. of the human species, is the creation of a cabinet-level department on an equal par with the Interior, with the Defense Department, with Education, with Health and Human Services, with State, with all of the cabinet secretaries who have the President's ear on a daily basis and who are running major aspects of this global society from Washington, D.C., certainly on behalf of the 300 million people who are citizens of the United States. I am proposing, and I need your help to get it in front of the right people in the next 2 weeks, that we create a cabinet-level position, which I am proposing we call the Department of the Exterior, which will basically handle the technical, social, religious, scientific, and cultural aspects of our encompassing of the wonders and surprises in the solar system, the energy resources, the material resources, the histories of the planets, and most critically, who was there before us and its relationship to the human race here on planet Earth. This is bigger than NASA. NASA was the creation of the Cold War, the race between East and West. That is gone. It is a different era. It is a different century, George. It requires a different answer, and it requires an institution which thinks as big as the vision that this president has enunciated before the world.
This is the Richard Hoagland I like to hear. You got some guts. Let's go to some calls. First time caller line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, am I on there?
Yes, you are, sir.
This is Mike from Auburn, Washington.
Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Well, it's a very big honor to talk to you and also to Richard.
Hi, Mike.
And I wanted to ask a question. I was thinking that suddenly there's talk about disclosure. And could this be because the government might know that something is up? Maybe ETs, UFOs are going to make some kind of official landing, and they want to kind of pre-sensitize us for that, or kind of preparing us for some kind of a big landing or big disclosure, not so much by our own government, but by the ETs themselves.
All
could
right.
this be one reason why they would want to do this?
Interesting question. Richard, I've always wondered if they're trying to soften us up first.
Well, if you look back at Brookings, all right, the Brookings Report, which is this official NASA study commissioned in 1959 as NASA was being born, Brookings said it 40, 50 years ago. It said basically the American people, the world, is not ready for the information of the reality of extraterrestrials if they exist. And it basically said there will be required decades of a conditioning process to get them ready. I'm paraphrasing, of course. This was an official study. It had sociologists, it had military people, it had historians, you know, lawyers, industry folks. Margaret Mead, I worked with Margaret Mead when I was at the Hayden Planetarium there in New York City. She was deathly afraid of the destruction of civilization with contact with a higher level consciousness or technology if there wasn't adequate preparation. So I see the last 50 years as preparation for the inevitable. That's what Steve believes. That's what Bassett believes. That's what a lot of the people in this field believe, that day of inevitability is coming. The question is, when will it arrive? Well, as you begin to look at these clues, these data points, these little, you know, between the lines things going on, you said it a little while ago. It's a convergence it looks like this time is approaching. And so I see this as part of a natural process that somebody set in motion decades ago. We're fortunate to be near the end of the ending and the beginning of a new beginning, if we're right.
Do you think it might be a presidential issue? Not going to Mars, but some kind of disclosure, or do you think both candidates, or major candidates, will just kind of put their hands off that?
I think that for plausible deniability, that when the life on Mars question is raised, it's going to be NASA again, because NASA is part of an administration. It's part of the government infrastructure,
but
it will not have the weight and majesty of the president until there is the reaction from society. There might be a presidential commission set up to look at implications, to look at accelerating. But I mean, can you imagine what that announcement will do to George Bush's timetable?
Well, it would have to speed it up.
It would speed it up, and the necessity, I believe, absolutely fundamentally, for the creation of the cabinet-level Department of the Exterior to handle the implications.
And I want everyone to understand, when you're talking about full disclosures for some of those who missed the first hour, you're talking about the disclosure of what might be on Mars. We're not talking about disclosure of UFOs this point.
Not yet, because remember, their philosophy has been, we have to get them pregnant slowly. And this would be part of that drip, 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 time-release aspirin model that I've been laying out.
Unless they clone us. Always a possibility, Richard. Always a possibility. I mean, my gosh, the time is going quickly, Richard.
Isn't it?
We're
going
to come up to the end of the break, then we'll be right back. A few more phone calls, a couple more questions for you. And the tree picture, I'm still amazed by it. I mean, it is absolutely staggering. I mean, don't they look like trees to you?
They do. And again, Arthur, being one of the insiders, I think was trying to tell us years ago that we're coming up to the date when this announcement will be made.
I think you're right. Stay with us. Richard C. Hoagland, our guest. By the way, his website is enterprisemission.com. It's linked up with coasttocoastam.com. And also, Lex has posted under his name the website that he has mentioned a couple of times, moontomars.org. Makes it very easy for you just to go right to it and fill out the information and try to get Richard C. Hoagland and the Enterprise Mission before the committee. That would be fascinating.
Subscribe now by calling toll-free 1-888-727-5505.
That sounds like I have to do another full show. Richard, you ready to do another 4 hours with me?
So you want to start over?
let's do it all over again. Would you accept the cabinet position if it were offered to you? You would.
Well, the key thing here is that we can, if we do this right, if we start the legislation process, which is hearings on the Hill with the congressmen and others we're meeting with, and we build people in from the beginning so that it's a democratic, open position, We would forestall all the problems NASA has gotten into over the years. We would literally restructure this from the ground up so it has to remain open and transparent, as Steve Bassett has said. And that's what would make this different than the NASA that we now know. Now, let me tell you something else that's important. If you go to the Moon Mars website, the President Commission website, you'll see they've had 5,000 responses since January. 5,000. 1,000. That's nothing.
Oh, we'll do
there
that tonight.
There are millions of people listening that care about this. Remember when we were talking about the President's State of the Union about a year ago?
Mm-hmm.
And over a weekend we got 20,000 responses in
sure,
the White House?
Sure, absolutely.
If they don't call me, I frankly don't care, and I'll tell you why. If 100,000 people or 200,000 or a million were to respond to that website tonight and tomorrow and the next day and put this idea in front of the commission from the people, not from Dick Hoagland, but from the people, it will have a profound effect, a huge rippling effect, regardless of whether they ask me to come and talk to them. That's the key thing here, because there's only 5,000 responses since the president made the announcement. You guys out there can create what we call the tipping point. You can have a profound effect by simply making your voices heard tonight, expressing what you want to see happen, and a new vision for how to carry out this initiative, which I think is essential to the survival of the human species. If we don't get off this planet in a big way, we are going to be trapped in endless al-Qaedas and Iraqs ad nauseum for you, your children, your children's children. This is the only way out of the box and a future that we can all live with.
Yeah, that was Secretary Richard C. Hoagland there speaking. Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing? This is Sal from KXNT, Vegas.
Hi, Sal. Welcome.
George, it's great to be on the show. Always a good show. I wanted to ask Richard, well, first I want to say it's an excellent idea for the Department of the Exterior, and it's a flashy name as well. It should have been created, I think, at least 25, 30 years ago, right after we landed on the moon.
You want to hear something really amazing?
Yeah.
This is not a new idea. I wrote this down. I'm trying to find the reference, and if anybody out there can do a Google search, I wrote it in print in an article in a magazine sometime in the last 30 years. I can't remember where. But I talked about the second age of space, and I talked about creating the Department of the Exterior at a time when I thought we needed a renaissance from NASA then, and I knew nothing then compared to what we now know. So, yes, it's an idea whose time is well overdue, because space to me has always been about people big time and the incredible influence on society and all our lives that this is trying to tell us. And NASA has been too small to handle the huge implications. It's obvious now in hindsight.
Did you guys hear about the satellite they just launched, or the
yes,
probe that was
Gravity Probe B?
Yeah, I think that'd be excellent oversight for a cabinet position. Can you elaborate on what that's about? I mean, it's supposed to be about testing Einstein's theories.
It's testing two subtleties of general and special relativity. It's been the longest space project ever designed or envisioned. It was begun theoretically back in the Eisenhower years, which was before NASA was born. They launched it a couple of days ago. It's supposed to last a few years in Earth orbit, measuring these incredible subtle effects on super polished quartz gyroscopes immersed in baths of liquid helium. And I'm going to bet you, George, a little side bet here.
Okay.
That the results are not going to conform to relativity, but will conform to hyperdimensional physics. Stay tuned.
If Albert were only alive today, I wonder what would the first question be, Richard, if you met Albert Einstein? What would you ask him? I'm throwing these great questions at you.
You really are. Boy, this one's going to go in the archive. I don't know. As a certain president said the other day, if you want to submit that question in writing, let me think about it.
I finally got Hoagland to not answer something.
That would be something I would have to think about, because you don't want to do something trivial. If you get one question, you want it to mean something. And frankly, at 5 o'clock in the morning, remember, I'm used to.
Oh, that's right. You've got
earlier time.
You're on another time.
I'm in another time zone.
Wildcard line. You're on with Richard C. Hoagland. Hi there.
Oh, hi. This is Martha in Concord, California.
Hi, Martha.
First of all, kudos to you, Richard. It's really wonderful what you're doing, what you're accomplishing. I do have a worry, though, and I've had this for many, many years. You know, I started tuning into what NASA was doing with Project Galileo, and of course NASA was going to launch a plutonium-powered, rocket, and
yeah.
And of course it, you know, if it had blown up on the launch pad, it would have killed all kinds of people. And so I've been alert to the worrisome aspects of all of this, and I wanted to ask you, please, 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 if you do get to present this to the organization in New York,
the President's Space Commission.
Correct. It would be. I'm concerned, and I think that the fact that some NASA people were announced the worry that perhaps the methane that they were now observing came because they admitted that they had not been sterilizing, and I don't know how they would, how the sterilization would be done, the probes that were sent to Mars, that perhaps that's where the methane was coming from, which, probably isn't the case.
It is not, and in fact, that's probably disinformation. That's
okay.
Trying to head off the inevitable. Don't you see the desperation here?
No, I do. Yeah. But common sense and the fear that the worst science fiction nightmare might end up being our last gasp would be if we send more probes to Mars and they collect specimens and enough caution is not taken, and I don't know whether it's even possible to take enough caution, and they bring stuff back here which contains microorganisms that we have no immunity to, it would be so ironic if this were our destruction.
Well, there is an easy and simple silver bullet answer to that concern, and I totally agree that we must now think about it. In fact, the other day in the New York Times, and George, this is how I know that this is coming. It's one of my data points that it's inevitable.
Sure.
There was an op-ed page piece on Monday in the New York Times called Some Things Are Better Left on Mars with a gorgeous cartoon written by Olivia Judson, who is an evolutionary biologist at Imperial College in London. I actually spoke there a few years ago. She's author of Dr. Titania's Sex Advice to All Creation, The Definitive Guide to the Evolutionary Biology of Sex. They asked her, obviously weeks ago, to write an op-ed piece, six columns, on the back contamination dangers of bringing little life forms either directly or inadvertently back from Mars. And she talks in her piece how NASA's actually spending money now on the preparation of the quarantine facility. Now, you know they're not going to spend money unless they know there's something to spend money on.
Absolutely.
So here is the answer to your question. The way you should do it is not to bring it back to Earth at all. That's what we have the space station for. You rendezvous the capsules with whatever samples in the pristine isolation of outer space. You investigate them with glove boxes and containment in orbit hundreds of miles above the Earth, so there can be no contamination. That's the way you utilize the expanding resources of the president's vision so that you never have the contamination problem in the first place, because you have the barrier, the quarantine barrier of hundreds if not thousands of miles between the sample and the Earth's biosphere.
Precisely. Martha, thanks for your phone call. Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how are you tonight?
We are fine, thank you.
Man, I've had a lifelong fascination with this stuff, and Mr. Hoagland, you make me wish I was a better student in school.
Well, it's never too late.
Never too late. You're right, Richard.
What I wanted to ask, I'll try to make this short. I saw a special on PBS a while back about the origin of man as a species, and it was basically that we developed or we evolved partly based on our environment and our proximity to the sun. I got some ideas from that, and then recently I heard a show on Mr. Bell. A gentleman was talking about a report he got from a higher power detailing the Earth's future.
That was John Lear.
John Lear?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one of the things he said that sort of just went right by was that we are not the only humans in the universe, or the only humanoids in the universe. My question is this: has anybody ever considered the possibility that the human race was had at one time populated both planets?
Of course, that's you may have joined us late, but that's one of George's scenarios and one of mine.
Yep.
That in fact we may be looking at a terrestrial colonization in a previous epoch of civilization, where we colonized Mars, and then something happened, a catastrophe, and we retreated back to just the Earth, and we're going to rediscover our own roots, our own heritage, our own prior cycle of civilization all across the solar system.
I just love space, Richard. I love these topics. I mean, I can't keep away from it.
Well, there are so many answers in these questions, George, provided we can get the politics straight. Let me give you one example, hearkening back to the previous caller, the woman who curled up with the contamination worry.
Martha, yeah.
Martha, if we create the Department of the Exterior as part of the mandate, I would ensure, as part of the hearing process and the oversight process, that it would be mandated by law that it has to consider all kinds of alternative forms of energy, gravity manipulation, other kinds of physics, etc., because I know that they exist. There are demonstrations, there are experiments, there's technologies out there that would not require the use of nuclear ever again. But there's been no institutional mechanism to force them into the open. Wouldn't it be cool if under the president's initiative, in order to develop more efficient means of going to Mars and going to the moon and powering colonies and cities and spaceships, that we could force that into the commercial public sector and make use of it here on Earth? I mean, there's no limit to what we can do politically if we get our act together and think big enough.
No, there's no limit at all. As a matter of fact, by the way, though, if you are named a cabinet member, the secretary of the Department of the Exterior, you will make coast-to-coast must-listening for all governmental officials. You would do that as one of your first acts, Richard C.?
Absolutely.
First-time caller line will probably be our final call. You are on coast-to-coast. Hi there.
Is that me?
Yes, sir.
All right. I'm Shannon from Pittsburgh, and George and Richard, it's great to be on the phone with y'all.
Good to have you with us, Shannon.
I read Brett Saberhagen's book, Berserker, and they talked a lot about cedar ships, and I think that maybe when our sun was hotter and the universe was closer, that there might have been a lot more of these, and it's very likely that they colonized Mars first, and as our sun cooled down, then maybe Mars colonized the Earth, or something like that.
Very possible. Because of Mars' size, Richard, smaller than Earth, do you think it could have developed quicker?
Yes, that's both the mainstream view and our view. And Tom Van Planner and I gave a back-to-back, you know, that five-hour presentation on Sunday night, where we laid out the case for a Mars as a moon of a bigger planet, faster evolution, more accelerated development, and who knows what could have developed. You know, back to Saberhagen and his Berserker series, all of the most wild, far-out science fiction scenarios you have ever read, become possible now that we've got confirmation of methane and the whisker of potential life on Mars. It is a new dawn of a new universe, and politically we need to get in alignment with where this is going so we can take control, meaning people are in charge, not a faceless bureaucracy.
Richard C., in the waning moments that we have here, let's talk about the website again. Yours, of course, is enterprisemission.com, the one that you would like people to jump on board to get you an opportunity to speak before this commission, this committee, moontomars.org. I know you do not ask if anybody. Richard does not get paid appearing here on Coast to Coast, and obviously the Enterprise Mission keeps afloat by your help, of course. So if you want to go to the website and send a buck or two or $5, whatever you can spare, don't break yourself.
And I definitely want to push for the tapes of the X conference. It is historic. It's important background, because what's coming next is going to leave you dizzy unless you have the right foundation. And that website is www.lostartsmedia.com.
Yes, and that's linked up under YouTube.
Excellent. Now, how much time we got left?
I have a minute and a half.
Let me tell you something really interesting. Stephen Bassett ran for Congress, as you know, last year, and he lost in the 8th District of Maryland. Based on that, he has entered another campaign. Did you know this, George?
Now what?
Showtime, the television network, is doing a totally different reality series called American Candidate.
Oh, that's right. They want to get candidates who want to run for president.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Stephen has entered as a candidate and is leading with 60,000 votes so far worldwide.
Why don't we get him as a real candidate?
Well, because the ultimate winner of this television series, which is being put together by some very interesting people, and if you want to know what this is all about, it's AmericanCandidate.com. Just go to that website and you'll see Stephen Bassett is leading the field. The real-world implications of this are as follows.
What's the cutoff date, by the way? Do we know?
I think it's another 2 or 3 weeks.
So the sooner, the better.
The sooner, the better. You go and vote for Steve. But here's the point. If he makes it to the finalists, which are going to be starting selection in the next 2 weeks, he gets to enunciate this disclosure platform in an ongoing television series seen all over the world. The board of directors of this is a who's who of American politics, George.
Oh, that's great.
It's the head of the League of Women Voters. It's a historian that's on Chris Matthews all the time. They're serious heavyweight people. You just go and look at background of the show at that website. The point is, this is the platform to continue the disclosure process in the one medium that the planet gets over all others, which is television.
That's exciting. Are you his campaign manager?
Nope.
All right, well, let's do it. Let's go for Stephen Bassett. Richard, thanks. Call Art, would you?
I sure will.
Okay. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, that's Lex's backup webmaster, Barbara Simpson and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, roundtable discussion tomorrow. Until then, be safe, everyone.